So let me start by thanking David and Julia for inviting me here today. As a matter of fact, 2 years ago, I was here as well talking about the exact same case. At the time, the hearing had just taken place. And it's great to see that, at least from an academic's perspective, maybe not from an industry perspective, that it's still such a... there's still so much attention to all these issues. So earlier this month, some of you might have seen this big live-streamed debate in New York between Paul Nemitz, Jonathan Zittrain, and two others. And so I was very surprised at the time that even between these people, but also in many other debates, that there's still people talking, you know, about mixing up different issues, different concepts, different rights. They're not talking about the same stuff, actually. Still so much misunderstandings are injected into the debate, which often makes, you know, not for a constructive debate. So that's why I thought that I'd take this opportunity at the beginning of the day also to, you know, clarify and delineate some of the issues so we're all on the same wavelength for the rest of the day. And of course, there's many many things I could talk about. So I tried to center them around two main topics. So first of all, conceptual issues, and secondly, the whole censorship argument that often always comes back. So first of all, conceptual. So as you all know, the right to be forgotten is a very evocative concept, void of any clear legal meaning, but we're all kind of guilty of using it in this debate. So I'm sure most of you know the movie this picture is from. So the Man in Black, they have this device called the Neuralizer, which makes witnesses to an alien incident, you know, forget what they have just seen. And so in debates, often this right to be forgotten is considered to be the legal equivalent of such a neuralizer, which, I mean, frankly, is a bit absurd. We cannot make people forget what they have just seen, let alone with a legal instrument, right? So if you look more closely at this term, I think it makes more sense to look at it as an umbrella term for a lot of already existing rights. Right? The droit à l'oubli, or right to oblivion, if you will, the right to object, right to erasure, now the right to be delisted. So I'll quickly run through them. Droit à l'oubli, as you might have guessed, French origin. It's case law based. There's no clear legal ground. Depending on the facts of the case, judges have used, you know, the general right to privacy, IP rights, tort law even. So it all depends. And the underlying rationale is actually to prevent republication of information that would have a disproportionate impact on an individual. The classic example is an ex-convict who 10 years after being released from prison sees information popping up again. And so it's this whole idea of starting anew with a clean slate. And by definition, there will always be a conflict with information freedoms. But if you look at case law, courts have always found a balance. And there's only in a limited number of cases this right has been accorded. And traditional media outlets have also developed code of conduct, you know, to deal with these kinds of requests. And of course, with the digitization of news archives and the internet in general, the potential number of cases has increased dramatically in the last decade or two. So right to erasure and right to object, contrary to this droit à l'oubli, right to oblivion, they have a specific legal ground in the Data Protection Directive. And so rather than focused on avoiding publication of information, these are intended to empower data subjects in their relationship with data controllers, to exercise some control over what happens with your data. And to that extent, you could look at them as sort of tools in the data protection toolbox that could be used for a variety of purposes. And then finally, the right to be delisted originated in the Google Spain case, though it was never explicitly used as such by the Court of Justice itself. It's only in the aftermath that people started using it, but now it's commonly accepted as the term to refer to use in this context, even by the Article 29 Working Party. And here the rationale, and that's at least how the court saw it, it's because search engines create such detailed profiles of information on whatever you're looking for, and combining information from all over the internet and compiling a very detailed profile. And of course, this is the main reason why we use search engines in the first place, but it also explains why it has such a potentially big impact on whatever you're looking for, especially if that's a person. And in a way, this is a great example of where all of the previous rights overlap, right? Because to a certain extent, the goal is similar to the droit à l'oubli, avoid further publication, but specifically based on data protection rights, targeting a very particular processing operation. And because I cannot stress this enough, and you still see this misunderstanding in debates, it's a very narrow scope of application. It's really about the link between a name search, between a search term and a search result. And I'm certain I will talk about this later during the day, to what extent this might translate to other kinds of search engines, internal search engines, website-specific search engines, or other information intermediaries like social networks, for example. Okay, the censorship issue, right? Unsurprisingly, the ruling was welcomed with a massive panic attack about how it would be the end of freedom of expression online. And indeed, many find it very surprising that the court did not mention once this fundamental right to freedom of expression. So what I will try to do in the last 5 to 10 minutes of my of my presentation is say don't panic, right? So I will do this by going to four different kinds of arguments that we often see returning. First of all, public versus private nature of personal data. Now, this is often presented as a binary. Even if information, personal information, is published in the tiniest corner of the internet, it's part of the public domain, and you would have there would be no limits to its further dissemination. You could freely link to it, etc., etc. I mean, in this line of reasoning, soon everything will become public, right? Because so much stuff is being digitized today, and with your smartphones, all of our interactions happen online. Bruce Schneier has called it the loss of the ephemeral. Everything is being stored today. And this whole line of argumentation, in my opinion, ignores that this public versus private nature of data it's not a binary, it's a continuum, right? And you have many different in-between states. Just listed a couple of them. There's depending on the case, you shouldn't look at it as one or the other, and depending on the nature of the information or the nature of the publisher, the nature of information will be in a different place on this continuum. It's the whole idea also of practical obscurity that Woodrow Hartsock has written about. So, secondly, the position of internet search engines. As you all know, we're becoming increasingly dependent on search engines, or any information intermediary for that matter, to access all kinds of information online. And Google is often the first page we go to when browsing the web, when looking for something. And in that regard, you could consider them, because consider search engines as a funnel or a strainer through which we access most information online. And this is, as I said before, their most valuable characteristic, to find the information you need, compile a profile as detailed as possible about your search term with all the information that is out there. But it's also the reason why it has such a potentially big impact on the person you're looking for if you're using a person's name as a search term. And it's important to keep in mind that this funnel in the middle there is the underlying decision-making process for compiling this profile on the basis of whatever search term is entirely or largely secret. It's by no means neutral. So we have to be aware, briefly, that this is, you know, these are corporate black boxes, almost unilaterally deciding what we get to see. And sure, they do a very good job of it, but we have to be aware that, you know, it's based on algorithms that are designed with a specific purpose in mind. All right, next. And this is related to the previous point. Actually, so much of the arguments that you see returning in the discussions is that Google or search engines equal the internet, and by extension, all information out there. If something would be removed from Google, even just on the basis of a search, of a name search, you would alter history. So at one of these Google hearings, I'm not sure where anymore, I think someone from Index on Censorship even said that the ruling would endanger investigative journalism. So I'd be very wary of the investigative journalist who would only use Google as you know, his primary resource. And so they might be looked at as the strainer through which, you know, we access information, but we should be very wary of considering them our window to the internet. Paul Bernal, I think, is here. In a blog post, he argued that we should look at search engines as we already look at Wikipedia. You know, it's a good start to, if you're looking for information about a certain topic, but by no means, you know, the definitive authoritative source. So on that note, it's also interesting to see that Wikipedia has very strong guidelines in place, enforced massively on the presence or deleting or maintaining personal data on their pages. So it's also that also makes it very strange that Jimmy Wales was so heavily opposed, you know, in these Google hearings. All right, finally, the rights of publishers. Often returning point, not touched upon really by the Court of Justice. What about the publishers? Don't they have a right, you know? So first of all, I think this is a largely overplayed point. Looking at the limited numbers that are available in Google's transparency report, we see that the top 10 websites that are targeted are by no means legitimate news sources. It's social networks, it's people search engines. So all third parties actually by themselves. So do we really want to give these actors a voice? And then secondly, and more importantly, I think this argument seems to presume that publishers have a right to be indexed in the first place. And of course, no one argues that search engines play a very important role in exercising one's freedom of expression. You know, there's also a lot of European Court of Human Rights case law also protecting the means to effectively exercise one's right to freedom of expression. But does this imply that publishers have a right to be included in a search engine based on specific search terms? Should Google, should they allow publishers to put their information in the top rankings? They actually do this already. It's called Google Ads. So with regard to the organic results, as I said before, it's a black box. Anyone even trying to game this, the algorithms even risks the so-called Google death penalty, you know, being entirely banned from the search engine. So this whole argument and the other arguments as well, aren't we giving Google too much credit? In a democratic, open society, don't we want diversity in our sources of information? In January this year, at CPDP in Brussels, Mark Rodenberg of Epic, he said that the news media suffer from a Stockholm syndrome vis-a-vis Google. And they're taken hostage by them, but cannot live without. So I think on that note, I'll stop and welcome any questions later on.